Today on The Grave Talks, the historic Rugby Village, a conversation with Miranda Young. Some people call it one of the most haunted towns in America, Rugby, Tennessee, nestled in the quiet corners of Northeast Tennessee. Founded in 1880 by the renowned author Thomas Hughes, Rugby was envisioned as a utopian village, a beacon of harmonious living. However, Hughes's dreams were dashed, and tragedy struck when typhoid fever claimed the lives of many of its early inhabitants. Today, Rugby stands frozen in time, its Victorian charm preserved amidst the rolling hills and whispers of the past. Its population is just 75, and perhaps more if you count the spirits that allegedly linger among its quaint streets. For those intrigued by the paranormal, Rugby offers an irresistible invitation. Here, the veil between the worlds is said to be thin, with hauntings reported in almost every building in this tiny town where the past is alive and the spirits seem to roam freely. Today on The Grave Talks, we explore the ghosts of the historic Rugby Village with Miranda Young. Well, Miranda, thank you so much for joining me yet again. And if people haven't listened yet, we have two other episodes that Miranda and I did, and one is called Ghost Biker Explorations. That, would you call that like your hobby? I don't know. Do you have time for a hobby? When do you fit your ghost biker exploration stuff in lately?
Well, we're still running strong with Ghost Biker. We had a great sixth season. You know, I'd say it definitely started as a hobby. I never would have thought that would have led to my full-time job, running the jail and then now the location we're going to talk about tonight. They all kind of go hand in hand together, but Both Christy and I decided that whenever we formed our company, History Highways and Haunts, we decided that we would definitely make time for her team, Soul Sisters Paranormal, and then mine, Ghost Biker Exploration. So we always make time since that's kind of what started everything.
And that's what you love, too. I mean, you're unique in that you will investigate solo, which very few people do that. You're really the exception. There's not many people who do that at all.
No, there's not.
But I would think for you, that would be kind of getting back to your roots a little bit in that investigation.
Yeah. It is. And the fact that a lot of the places that I like to cover, those are ones that are a little bit lesser known, a little more local legends or places that maybe people have never really been investigated before, people hadn't really heard of. I get to work with tourism commissions and chambers of commerce and then the travel industry with Harley Davidson and different folks like that. I get to work with these different people and utilize the paranormal in a unique way. It really is kind of getting back to my roots and doing really what I love. So since it's a passion, it's important that I make sure that I keep doing that.
And on our last episode about the historic Scott County Jail, check that out. Because it was a great episode. At the very end, we were talking, you and I, and you said, well, I do have another place that we could talk about. I'm like, what is this other place? And it's a historic Rugby. It's in Rugby, yes. Tennessee. This community has such an interesting history.
Yes.
And it's, when you look at the photos of it, it looks like you've stepped back into time.
Yes.
And so it's got many of the original buildings, but I want you to tell the story of how Rugby came about.
Yeah, so rugby is something that's really fascinating for anyone that doesn't know. It's about 20 miles from where we're located in Huntsville, Tennessee, with the historic Scott County Jail. And so I grew up in this area, and so rugby was always a part of my childhood. I took piano lessons over there and had some friends that lived in that area. So I was always very interested in the community itself. But rugby was established in 1880 by Thomas Hughes. Thomas Hughes was an Englishman who, he was also an author. He was a statesman there. He was, he had a lot of titles, but essentially he was the author of Tom Brown's School Days, and he was very well known all around the world. And so he had decided that he had this idea. It was a to establish a community that was a Christian socialist community, and he did it for the Second Sons of England. So at that time, in around 1877, 1878, there was a recession that was going on. And so a gentleman out of Boston, he had purchased lots of land over here on the Cumberland Plateau. And his idea was to establish a community here for some of the workers in Boston to help during this recession. Well, in 1878, the recession ended. And so he decided that he wasn't going to establish that community. So he was looking for another investor. And that's where Thomas Hughes enters. Thomas Hughes was interested in the land here. And so he ended up investing in it. And basically, during that time, there was something known as primogentry over in England. And if you're not familiar what that is, basically that is that all of the first sons of England, if you came from nobility, you got a great inheritance, you had a job, you the first sons got everything. The second and third sons, they really didn't have, they had limited jobs that they could get. They basically had an allowance. There wasn't a lot for them to do. So Thomas Hughes's idea when he established the community here in Rugby was for those second and third sons to be able to come over here. They would work with the Board of Aid to Land Ownership, and they would basically, whatever they contributed into the community would be what they got out of it. And the idea was for them to come over and work the land. And so, in October 5th of 1880, rugby is essentially open for business at this point. There are only just very few structures that are there at the time. But families started coming over. And so these rugby was kind of, in a way, it was sort of doomed from the start, because you're expecting these second and third sons to come over and work the land, and they really didn't have any idea of what they were supposed to do, really.
It's an interesting concept, mm-hmm. But then when you kind of think it through, all of these second and third and fourth sons could have gone out and gotten jobs, and, you know, that nothing's being handed to them. But I think it's interesting that he wanted to do it as a community. And I'd read where it had been referred to as a utopian community. Was he kind of thinking that these people would come and they'd be like-minded, they would be working together? So it's not so much about how much money someone makes. It's about working together to provide for each other.
Exactly. And that's where the Christian socialist idea came in with this. So essentially, it was supposed to be the second great British colonization, and he kind of called it, you know, his Garden of Eden. And the thought was that, you know, anyone, as long as you contributed, they had to contribute so much to the commissary, but as long as you contributed and as long as you were of the Christian faith, anyone could come and live there, and it didn't really matter your status, your race, anything like that. They were very open like you said, essentially everyone working together for the betterment of the community.
How did that go? How did that work for them? Once he got some people there and they, you know, it didn't spring up overnight. I'm sure it took years to build the infrastructure of the community. And it's not a huge community.
It's not. No, in its heyday, there were about 300 to 400 people that was there during its heyday. But after Rugby opened for business in October of 1880, they had the worst winter that had been in the area for a very, very long time. The two rivers, the White Oak and Clear Fork rivers there, they froze solid. And a lot of these Englishmen were not really used to the harsh climate that we have here on the Cumberland Plateau. And so there were already several people. And of course, by the time they came at that point, a lot of them were living in very almost crude tent-like structures at the time. And so there were several people that were already ready to kind of throw their hat in and go back by early spring of 1881. So in order to boost morale, Thomas Hughes's 84-year-old mother, she actually loads up all of her worldly belongings, hops on a ship, takes a 12-day cruise over here to Rugby, and settles. And that's where she ends up living the rest of her life out. She brought, it was her granddaughter, Emily Hughes, which would have been Thomas Hughes's niece, and then her other son, Hastings Hughes, which was Emily's dad. And so she came over here, and she was the matriarch of the community. And basically, she rallied. Her goal was to rally the people who were there and really kind of motivate them to stay. And so I actually just finished reading a book that has letters that Emily Hughes corresponded with one of her friends there in England. And that was from pretty much the time they landed here up until about 1887. And it gave such a great picture of what life was like here at Rugby during her time here. And so there were several problems, as I had said. The main one was a lot of people weren't prepared. Also, there were not really clear land titles going through, because basically when they came to America, and they would deal with the Board of Aid to Land Ownership, that they had a headquarters that was there in Rugby, and then it went to Boston from there, but the main leadership was still over in England. And so they had a real hard time getting clear land titles. And then, of course, Thomas Hughes, even though he was the founder, they really didn't have good leadership, because he was really back and forth from England. He never really lived over here at Rugby. He came when they first opened, and then he didn't come back for 3 years. And then he would typically come once a year and stay. So not having really clear leadership also made things kind of a challenge for the Rugbians as well.
Well, they needed a mayor or someone like that. You know, the person that's who we go to, and, you know, some sort of structure of leadership, I would think.
Yeah, you know, and they had managers of the community, and Boston was sending people down, you know, to check and make sure things were going as they had planned. But it just didn't have, I guess, the best infrastructure as far as starting out. And then during the summer, not very long after Madam Hughes and her granddaughter Emily comes to Rugby, there's a typhoid fever breakout there in the summer. Now, they had major drought, major heat, and there was so one of the main social gathering spot there, and this, of course, this was built when rugby started, it was known as the Tabard Inn. And that was one of the original structures that was there whenever rugby opened in 1880. The Tabard Inn was a very large, beautiful inn that was supposed to really encourage travelers to ride the Cincinnati-New Orleans Railroad down, and then to essentially kind of summer there in the mountains as a retreat. And so it's believed that the typhoid epidemic actually started there at the Tabard Inn. Storage of the meat was where they were storing that. It ran perpendicular with the well ran perpendicular with the sewer line there. And so they believe that that was what was sort of the start of the typhoid outbreak. And so there was 27 people that ended up catching that. Most of them believe it was gotten from there at the Tabard Inn. And seven of those 27 ended up passing away.
So this little utopian community got off to a really rough start.
Yes.
Really rough start. And yeah. I do find it interesting that his mother came all the way over here at 84 years old. My
Very
mom's
impressive.
86, and she could not do that. Even in today's times, she could not do that. But yeah. That he kept going back and forth. Was he just trying to recruit more people? Was it business that he was conducting?
A lot of it was business. He was very, very well known. And so when he would come to the U.S., a lot of these major cities were actually vying for his attention. Boston, New York, Chicago, Chattanooga, they were vying for his attention when he would come to the States. And so, he was often conducting business. His brother, Hastings, he was there a whole lot, more than Thomas Hughes. And I believe he was a sherry importer. And so, especially based on those letters that I had just got done reading, he was conducting a lot of business in New York and in Boston as well. So a lot of it would have been business that would have caused them to travel. I think Thomas Hughes, when he went back, I think he had kind of fallen ill. So there was a lot of conflict between him and his doctors as far as coming over and making the trip. And I think that's why there was such a stretch between him, between the establishment and when he came back over.
Did he bankroll rugby, or did everybody kind of not only donate their time and talents to building infrastructure, but were they expected to contribute financially as well?
I believe that the people, when they were coming to rugby, I think they had to commit, I believe, $5 to the commissary. Thomas Hughes, I believe he invested $175,000 of his own money.
Which was a lot then.
Yeah, that would have been a lot. And so his wife actually never came over to rugby. She really didn't believe in the cause, and I think was quite upset that he had invested that money. He pretty well, he invested. Now, there were some other investors, railroad tycoon, timber. A timber tycoon. So there was several different, they had different investors that was part of that board of aid to land ownership that also invested in it.
And they built some buildings that are still standing today, and quite a few of them.
Yes. Yes. So in its heyday, I believe there were 68 structures that were there. And I believe, I'm trying to remember the number of structures that are still standing today. I believe that there are 16 original structures that are still standing today. But Rugby is actually a living village. And so with inside of it, you can go and you can stay. They've got several buildings. One of them is one of the original boarding houses, which is Newberry. Also, let's see, the Thomas Hughes's house that he built there in 1884, which again, he never lived in, but the rector of the church ended up living in there. His original house is still standing. The library is such an amazing structure. It's the original first lending library here in the South. And so they have 7,000 books inside of there. And it is such a crazy thing. They actually have only had 7 that had not been returned in out of the 7,000.
Oh, wow.
And we actually just returned
That's
one
impressive.
Of them. Yeah, we just returned one of them. We had a paranormal team return one of the books that they had gotten from a yard sale. But anyways, yes, there are still 16 of those that are still standing, and you can go in and tour on those or some of those, and because a few of them are privately owned, and also investigate, I believe, 5 of those different structures. I believe today there's maybe 50 to 60 people that are current residents that still live in Rugby today.
Has there been people living in Rugby this entire time? It never did really turn into a ghost town, did it?
It really didn't. Now, it never became an actual ghost town, really, as far as, you know, Rugby's heyday, if you will, was around 1884 or 1885, was really it when it was at its heyday, when it was successful. The Tabard Inn ended up burning twice. And so that really was one of the big things that caused the major decline. After it burned the first time, they rebuilt it. And then it ended up burning again. And so when that was the case, there wasn't really as much of a draw for the people to go and visit there. And so, and then of course, Madam Hughes ends up dying actually on the date on October 5th, 1887, just 7 years to the exact date of when Rugby was established. So she ended up passing away at that point. And then Thomas Hughes never really came back after his mother had passed. And so a lot of the original colonists did at that point in time move on because either they didn't get their land title clear. And that was just some of them. But they moved on for whatever reason. And so there would have been a handful of people that did stick around. And then there were several folks that the Waldens, that they were involved, you know, they were management and stuff that kind of carried on. They stayed there and took care of the village, but it wasn't until 1966, whenever 16-year-old Brian Stagg ended up getting just absolutely fascinated and writing a book about historic Rugby at that point. And so he had a very good vision about how he wanted to restore as well as keep Rugby alive. And so Historic Rugby Inc. was founded at that point. It was put on the National Historic Registry in the early 70s. And so the nonprofit was established. And so he spearheaded that. And that's when they started going in and remodeling the structures and set forth what we have today. And so really, I guess you could technically say that Rugby was successful because they're still around. But as far as the original idea that Thomas Hughes had, that pretty well kind of faded out right around, you know, 1900.
I find it so interesting, you know, with you living in Tennessee, I'm in Kansas, you know, and when you think about the rural parts of our country, there are so many little towns that never made it that yes. Also, you know, were quite established during the day. And so the fact that this little town has survived it all, let alone when you look at the photos of it, it makes you want to go visit. Like they've done a really good job of preserving it.
Absolutely. I mean, when they started doing this, I mean, Brian Stack had such a great vision for this, and it was something that was so important to the folks in that area that it was really no question. And I'm so glad that they did preserve this, because it even goes to the point to where the folks that live there today, there are a couple subdivisions in there that are somewhat newer, but they had to build their homes in that same Victorian style, in the same color scheme. I mean, they were very strict about if you wanted to live in Rugby, but not necessarily live in one of the original historic structures, you still had to keep it in that same vein. So they take their restoration and preservation very seriously.
So here's the million-dollar question. How did you end up getting involved with historic Rugby?
So being that it was so close, I actually took piano lessons there when I was a kid. And so I knew about this haunting activity because one of the stories that I like to tell, Miss Stagg, which was actually Brian Stagg's mother, she taught me piano lessons. And I can remember the house she lived in. It's called Roslyn. And I can remember sitting there playing piano and hearing what sounded like horse carriages just come up to the house on this driveway. And it sounded like just a herd of horses rushing toward the house. And I can remember stopping and looking at my piano teacher and Miss Stagg, you know, kind of swatting at my hand and saying, "Keep playing, it happens." And so I can also remember hearing some of these different stories that different residents had told about some of the haunting activities that happened there. And so after Christy and I formed History Highways and Haunts and opened up the jail, we were just, you know, kind of sitting there talking one day and got the idea to approach Rugby, because the way the town is set up, it's just an obvious choice and such a great fit to have lantern tours there, because they have the reputation of being one of the most haunted villages in America, and it's just structured like that for a walk. So we put together a plan, reached out to Historic Rugby Inc. and pitched the idea to them. And so they actually had their board come to the jail and take one of our ghost walks that we do there, because we wanted to show them what we've done with our location and talk about the possibilities of ways that they can actually earn more revenue through an after dark tourism program. And that's one of the things, these nonprofit villages and towns and museums and such, that rely on daily tourists to come in. That's a really hard thing right now, especially coming out of the pandemic and stuff, and people just really starting to pick up on travel. And so they loved what we had done. They loved the idea, and they're so supportive, and they even stepped up, and we had so many villagers and residents that was sharing some of their different stories of what they had encountered, either ones that work there or ones who live there. And so it took about 6 months to really get it kicked off. And so in May of 2023, we opened up the Downtown Village Lantern Tour, Paranormal Investigations and Guided Ghost Hunts. And then in October, we added a second lantern tour, which is the north end of the village. And that takes you to the Tabard Inn burn site, as well as the cemetery that's there. So really, we've been running two tours out of there every week since the end of October. And then teams that have been coming and doing investigations there, because Rugby, while it's had this interesting haunting history, they didn't really embrace it a whole lot until we came on, and now they're all about it, and we've had so many cool experiences and stuff that have happened with paranormal teams. And then just on our lantern tours, we've had some really great experiences as well.
Do you think it's like so many people, if they talk about the paranormal, then it's real, or they're giving it credibility when really, you know, there's no such thing as any of this. But then, you know, when you think about it, here's little Miranda just having a piano lesson and you hear horses, and it's so common to your teacher that she's like, keep going.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't even think, you know, that's how day to day that is to her. Like, she doesn't even stop her piano lesson.
Absolutely. And, you know, in going and researching, we found that the family that lived in Roslyn originally, they actually used to race horses and carriages on the original road right there that ran right by Roslyn. So it was really cool. Once we started doing our research and finding all that, we were actually finding accounts of things that had happened back, you know, when Brian Stagg was younger, and when he was, you know, had this dream of, you know, restoring historic rugby. Yeah. And that's what a lot of the residents, and then even the general manager there at rugby and the tour docents and stuff, they'll talk about things on a daily basis that they encounter. Chrissy, the lady that does the maintenance, or not, excuse me, not the maintenance, but does the housekeeping there in all of the houses. Every time we see her, she's got a new story of something that she's experienced there on a daily basis when she's going in and taking care of the homes. And the stories are very consistent throughout from people who are there on a daily basis. And I absolutely love it. And really, since we've done this, it's almost, in a way, it's almost sort of created a safe space where people can share these stories of what they're encountering, because right. Most of the time they're like, you may not believe me when you hear this, but let me tell you this weird thing that happened. It's really cool every time we meet with them, because they always have a couple new stories of things they've experienced there.
Because it is nice to be able to share, especially like for the housekeeper, for example. She's mm-hmm. probably, she's in these buildings alone frequently, I would guess. Mm-hmm. Yes. And she's having these experiences. To be able to share that without judgment and someone mm-hmm. believe you, it's so validating. Because
absolutely.
There's times where you think, am I crazy? Am I just hearing this? I'm sure you've encountered that. Am I really yes. hearing this? Is this in my mind? Am I really experiencing this? You start questioning yourself.
You do, especially, you know, and then you get to where you're experiencing it on a daily basis as well. And then it just kind of, I don't want to say you become numb to it, but it's just another day in the village, you know, or just another day in the jail. And you get to where it's like, okay, did anyone else experience this at the same time? Or is this just me? And, you know, a funny story that comes out of there, you know, when we do our lantern tours, we will show, you know, we'll show evidence, play audio, show pictures, that sort of thing, of things people have captured from there. And one of the extremely haunted houses there at Rugby is known as Newberry House. And Newberry House was originally a boarding house, and it's still a boarding house today that you can go and stay in. And I think it sleeps 14 people, I believe. And one of the most famous spirits that is in rugby, known as Charles Oldfield, he did end up passing away there in Newberry. Well, they were taking a picture for one of their Christmas cards there in front of Newberry, and is just this beautiful snow-covered scene of Newberry House. There's nobody inside the house. And upstairs, where Charles Oldfield is typically seen, there is a figure in the window. And they didn't even notice it at first. And it wasn't until they had sent it out, and I think even for a while they were selling it in the gift shop, someone mentioned, said, you know, you've got a ghost in the upper window. And they actually ended up pulling it because they, at the time, they just didn't really embrace that, that side of the paranormal. And so, and plus they didn't want anyone to think they had staged something like that. And so, it was such a cool capture, and we show that on the tour because it's like some of the best captures are by accident anyways. Mm-hmm. And this one, there is clearly someone in Victorian attire looking out one of the upper windows, and there was absolutely nobody inside that house.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation about historic Rugby Village with Miranda Young. For more information on Rugby, visit their website at historyhighwayshaunts.com, or you can find them on Facebook at Historic Rugby After Dark. For more information on Miranda Young, you can search Ghost Biker Explorations on Facebook. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, get everything without the commercials, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts, where you can try it for 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and you'll find everything there. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.